89 KUNM.
Coming up on the Colin Show, we'll talk about Native American language education in New Mexico. How are Native American languages taught in schools in New Mexico? What are the unique language needs and histories of Native American communities here in New Mexico? We'd like to hear from you. You can send us an email to callinshow@kunm.org, or you can call in live during the show. That's just after the news from National Public Radio. This is New Mexico's community-powered public radio, KUNM and KUNM HD 89.9 Albuquerque Santa Fe, KBOM 88.7 Socorro, KRAR 91.9 Espanola, KRRT 90.9 Arroyo Seco Taos, and KRRE 91.9 Las Vegas. We're streaming live online at KUNM.org. It's 8:01. News is next.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Details of a $26 billion settlement with five of the nation's largest banks are being announced at this hour. The aim is to help more than 2 million households caught up in the foreclosure crisis. Dozens of states want to hold the banks accountable for foreclosure abuses. NPR's Craig Windham is with us now. And Craig, good morning. What kind of help will this settlement provide?
Well, Paul, homeowners who owe these banks more than their homes are worth will see their mortgage balances reduced, or they'll be able to refinance at a low rate, and people who've already lost their homes to foreclosure will each get a check for about $2,000.
What do we know about whether $26 billion is enough to have a major impact, Craig?
Well, it may and it may not. Here's Gus Fauché, senior economist with PNC Financial.
Currently, mortgage owners are hundreds of billions of dollars underwater on their home loans, so I think this will help, but it's not going to be the cure-all for the housing market.
But Fauché says the deal could prompt lenders to speed up the restructuring of loans.
Lenders can go back, look at some of the loans that are underperforming and see if they can do something about that, and that could have a larger impact.
And Fauché says the deal could also stabilize housing prices, which would help more people avoid foreclosure problems.
Thanks very much. That's NPR's Craig Windham with us this morning. Jobless benefit claims are down to a four-year low for last week. It's a sign of more job market strength, but economist Steve Bronars of Welch Consulting says the numbers mask a big problem.
People really like looking at this number, but like I think the emphasis should be that it's really only one part of it, and really where we're hurting is the long-term unemployed, which this really says nothing about.
Still, last week's figure is comfortably below a number most economists think indicates hiring that's strong enough to lower the unemployment rate. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wants an Arab League observer team to return to Syria, and a League official says the organization is considering whether to recognize the opposition Syrian National Council as the legitimate representative of Syria. This is Sound Online, purportedly of President Bashar al-Assad's government forces pounding the city of Homs. The BBC's Jim Muir is following developments in Syria from Beirut, Lebanon.
Early morning brought another barrage of rocket and shell fire, much of it focused on Baba Amr. Video posted on the internet by activists showed bodies being pulled from under the rubble of Homs. They said three whole families were among those who died in the latest bombardments. Syrian state TV has also been showing footage of intensive shelling and shooting in Homs, but it blamed the violence on armed terrorists, who it said had been terrorizing and killing citizens and firing mortars at public buildings and mosques. Security forces have also been in action near the borders with Iraq, Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon.
And that's the BBC's Jim Muir. Stocks in Europe are up today, and stocks in the U.S. have opened higher. The Dow Jones Industrial's up 31 points. This is NPR News.
KUNM programming is supported by the law firm of Rothstein, Donatelli, Hughes, Dahlstrom, Schoenberg, and Bienvenue, with offices in Santa Fe, Albuquerque, and Phoenix since 1976. For information, rothsteinlaw.com.
Good morning. This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Today, we're hosting a conversation on Native American language education in New Mexico. How are Native American languages taught in schools in New Mexico or taught in other locations and communities in New Mexico? And what are the unique language needs and histories of Native American communities here? Also, what can our educational professionals learn from what Indigenous language scholars are doing here in New Mexico? Joining us to discuss this morning, we have two professors from the Language, Literacy, and Sociocultural Studies Department at the University of New Mexico. It's part of the College of Education. We have Dr. Christine Sims. She is assistant professor in the department. She's also the director of the American Indian Language Policy Research and Teacher Training Center. We're also joined in the studio this morning by Rebecca Bloom Martinez. She is a professor, and she is director of the Multicultural Education Center for the College of Education. Good morning to you both, and thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
So I want to start by, well, first let me give the numbers out. We may have some eager callers. The numbers to call if you already have a question this morning are 277-5866 locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. And I wanted to start with you, Chris. Can you kind of set us up briefly with the history of Spanish colonization in New Mexico and how that has created a unique context for Native American language education today?
Well, if we look at New Mexico specifically in terms of its early history of contact with a foreign language, Spanish, we do have today examples of how that contact with that language did bring in some, you could say, borrowings of certain words and things into many native languages here in New Mexico. And specifically, of course, we're talking about the Pueblo languages that were already here in existence before the entrance of Spanish in the 1500s. But as well, we see that particular phenomenon of word borrowing happening even in Athabascan languages like Navajo and Apache. Those were probably the first, at least we know from historical records, that was probably some of the first interaction with such a dominant language in which there were some limited word borrowings, and those are mainly for items that were brought from Spanish culture. Mm-hmm. That would have been the first instance of where we would, indigenous languages would have had contact with a foreign language.
And how has the history of U.S. education policy with Native American communities in the U.S. and the punishment of speaking of Native languages, how has that affected what you see happening in communities now?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, following that early period of Spanish contact, you know, the 1500s, 1600s, then going in under the Mexican period of time, 1700s, then we come into a third era of a foreign, in a way, foreign intrusion into indigenous country here in the Southwest. The entrance of the federal government into American Indian country, especially here, we see, especially through the medium of schooling, where the federal government had very specific policies aimed at eradicating cultural ways, cutting the ties from children with their communities and their families through forced submersion in learning English in boarding schools. Those were some of the ways in which federal government education began to unravel many of the ways in which native languages would normally have been passed on through intergenerational transmission. That, by far, federal education of the 1890s, early 1900s, by far, had the most impact, I believe, in what we have today as a legacy of language attrition, where many of our languages now are at the brink of endangerment, meaning that through successive generations, many parents, perhaps because of these early experiences in which they were forbidden to speak their languages, then in turn, perhaps consciously or unconsciously, absorbed that attitude that maybe, or that a feeling that they didn't want their children to go through the same types of experiences. And that actually probably lasted for several generations.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca, I want to ask you to distinguish. Last week we hosted a conversation on dual education in New Mexico, which focused primarily on English and Spanish. Mm-hmm. And your specialty is in bilingual education and language revitalization. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of distinguish the differences between kind of a dual language education conversation like we were having last week about Spanish and English, and how Native American language education how is that different with respect to the population of students that we're talking about, and also the way that the languages kind of function in communities? All in one sentence. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I think you have to consider where the impetus for using languages comes from as one of the basic distinctions. So Spanish-English bilingual education, the impetus, yes, it's from communities and parents and so forth, but the impetus is for use in the schools so that Spanish becomes a medium of instruction and to teach essentially a similar kind of curriculum that exists in English, with obvious distinctions, but very similar. The impetus for learning indigenous languages in New Mexico, at least, is that these languages, that they be used in the community to perpetuate the lifestyle, the values, the whole culture of the communities. So using them in schools while it's being done presents a whole series of challenges that you don't generally have with Spanish.
Things like?
Well, if you have a program, a bilingual program that's Spanish-English in a school, you have people within the school system who are knowledgeable about how these programs work, and they are the ones who generally run them. With indigenous languages, if they are present in the school, they're there because the community wanted them placed there. And the control really should remain with the community. And one of the challenges is that it doesn't remain with the community. So you have these kinds of distinctions. And while we have heritage language funding through the Bilingual Education Act in New Mexico, the purpose for using these languages, as I said before, is to perpetuate the lifestyle of the community, the culture of the community. And that's not necessarily the best place for language to be in the schools.
We in our conversation before the show, you use the term world languages, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, kind of as a juxtaposition with heritage languages. Can you explain what you mean by that, and how that affects this conversation about bilingual education, dual language education, and heritage language education?
Well, you can use the term heritage language for world languages, but generally, I say world languages, meaning languages that are spoken in many different parts of the world and that are open to anyone to learn them. You know, Spanish, Mandarin, French, English, those kinds of languages. The indigenous languages, for the most part, especially here in New Mexico, are not used in other parts of the world. And the notion for many people who speak those languages is that this language is to remain for use only in the community from which it comes. And so they're not open to other people to learn them and so forth. And so you really have to be very careful if you're going to have a program in a school with an indigenous language, that all of these ideas and all of the ways in which the community views the language are respected.
If you'd like to join the conversation this morning on the KUNM call-in show, the number to call is 277-5866 in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. Do you speak your heritage language? Is it your first language? How is this possible for you to achieve? Or perhaps you want to learn your heritage language and it's not your first language. We'd like to hear from you. Again, 277-5866 is the number to call locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call 877-899-5866. That's our toll-free number. I'd like to hear, Chris, if you can talk a bit about the role that Indigenous languages play in communities and how that's different than the kind of world language distinction we've made with Rebecca.
Right. And what Rebecca has said is very true, that and this is oftentimes what people misunderstand or do not understand or appreciate fully, is that these particular languages, of course, have existed who knows for how many centuries of time. But these languages have been the means by which many of our Native communities have actually been able to carry on their own internal systems of governance. The whole social community network revolves around the use of language. And certainly, you know, key to every one of the communities here in New Mexico is the role that Native language plays in the spiritual, traditional spiritual practices and traditions of each of our communities. You know, without language, those things don't exist or can't be carried on or passed on. So in a way, the function of these languages is very much tied to each tribal community, which is oftentimes the reason why I refer to these languages as tribal languages. They're unique in that these languages, one, aren't spoken anywhere else in the world. Even with the many different languages that do exist in the United States, our Pueblo languages, for example, they're not tied to any other language groups in the U.S. Or in North America. So the function of these languages then becomes very crucial in terms of passing on not just the idea of speaking a language, but it's integrally tied to the values, the social and cultural values, the spirituality that people in these communities learn as they speak these languages. And that's really been the focus for a lot of efforts locally in tribes to address this issue of language revitalization, maintaining languages, restrengthening language.
Chris, can you explain part of what Rebecca said about how there is this belief that Indigenous languages should remain in and be used only by members of that particular community? Mm-hmm. Explain the history behind that.
Well, that's definitely a unique perspective, especially among Pueblo people. And I'm from Acoma Pueblo, one of the 19 Pueblos here in New Mexico. And that definitely is a perspective, I think, that that we find, especially among our communities, where, as I said, the language is so intricately tied to the deeper aspects of Native spirituality. And in a sense, probably a lot of the historical experiences of Pueblo people have been such that the very target of the different foreign governments that have entered into the New Mexico, starting with the Spanish, actually were aimed at eliminating Native cultures. They were seen as pagan. They were seen as something very opposite, you know, Spanish Catholicism, for instance, and much later, you know, Protestantism, you know. These languages actually to survive, except for the cultures to survive, in many cases had to go underground, so to speak, certainly during the Spanish period before the 1618 Pueblo Revolt. Spiritual traditional leaders were the target of many, you know, atrocious things that happened during that time. And so those practices, traditional things that would have been taken underground, probably along with it, of course, was language. And so there's always been this historical buffer, if you will, between the public use of language outside the spheres of the traditional community. And so that also then extends even to modern day times, where many Pueblo communities retain that particular perspective about language being used primarily within their community for their members. And so that particular kind of a perspective is often difficult for outsiders to understand and appreciate.
Well, and I have heard stories about some of the exploitation or abuse of mm-hmm. access that non-Native people have right. demonstrated, people who've become close and intimate with Native communities and then used their yes. knowledge in ways that they were not
yes.
They didn't have the authority or the agreement.
Exactly.
So part of it is that, right?
Yes it is.
But is that protectionism? I'm going to use the term protectionism because mm-hmm. it's kind of that mm-hmm. type of energy, right? Mm-hmm. Cultural survival required mm-hmm. this type of barrier.
Yes.
Is it still needed now?
Well, I tell you, right now, one of the biggest challenges, of course, we have today is the explosion of media, you know, the explosion of having or the seamen need to know things right away and to have the internet at your fingertips where you're able to, you know, have this kind of knowledge instantly. Those really are continuing challenges, I think, that many Native communities have in terms of how do we ensure that these languages continue for our people. How do we maintain the focus of language, considering that all of these other influences and challenges are bombarding from the outside? I think for many communities, that is still one of the probably single most challenges that we face today.
Rebecca, can you talk about how heritage language, indigenous language instruction differs from a dual language instruction in a school? For example, we talked a little bit about a kind of a holistic approach mm. to learning languages. Let me first give out the numbers real quick. 277-5866 is the number locally here in Albuquerque to call. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. I have Chris Sims and Rebecca Bloom Martinez. They are faculty members in the Language, Literacy, and Sociocultural Studies Department in the UNM College of Education, and we're talking about indigenous language education in New Mexico.
Well, the distinction, first of all, the theoretical basis for learning a second language or relearning a heritage language, I mean, these are kind of universal in terms of what are the elements that are needed for someone to learn a language.
Grammar, vocabulary, this kind of thing?
No.
Not so much?
More... do you have a person who is interested in interacting with the learner, who will make the learning possible by helping them through understanding how to use the language, by supporting them when they try to use the language, and so forth?
Patience.
Yeah. but precisely what you were just saying, grammar, vocabulary, these are more Western traditional mm-hmm. or Western traditions of how you learn a language. And
so I can demonstrate right here my the Western perspective that yeah. I have been educated highly in, right?
Unfortunately, some of these perspectives have not borne out. You know, we have lots of people who have taken languages in school or in the university, and they still can't speak the language. So that may not be the best way, but I'm not going to discuss that right now. So when you're trying to develop the language or the facility for using and understanding the language in, say, a Spanish-English program, use it by using certain techniques with the regular curriculum that exists. In these programs, I go back again, once again, to the whole notion of community. The reason that children or whoever it is that's trying to learn the language is learning the language is to be able to use it in the community in particular ways and with people. So what you have to do is, if you're going to do it in the classroom, you have to kind of recreate those situations so that students or whoever it is, the learners, can try to practice in that setting. And the wonderful thing I have seen about the ways in which these programs work is that what they are learning in the classroom might be, let's say it's a Friday or Thursday that they're learning this in the classroom. On Saturday, something might be going on in the community where they are immediately able to use it. So I think those are some of the distinctions. It doesn't mean that language learning as a process differs, but certainly the context mm-hmm. is incredibly different. And so those are the elements that you have to keep in mind, I think.
The number to call to join this conversation this morning is 277-5866 here in Albuquerque. You can also call 877-899-5866. That's our toll-free number. And we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Saggio's, homemade real Italian pizza, calzones, pasta, salads, and desserts, serving Albuquerque and the UNM community since 1968. Saggio's encourages support of public radio KUNM on Cornell Southeast across from UNM and at saggios.com.
I loved my car. We had some great times together. I gave it a pet name, had my picture taken with it, paid fortunes to keep it going. But no matter how hard I try, it's just not working for me anymore. So I'm not going to let it just sit there until it's totally wasted and meaningless. I'm sending it to KUNM, where it's really needed and can do some good. They'll turn it into great radio, plus give me a membership and tax deduction. It can all end so easily. All I have to do is call 888-KUNM-CAR.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. I'm joined in the studio this morning by two professors in the Language, Literacy, and Sociocultural Studies Department of the UNM College of Education, Chris Sims and Rebecca Bloom Martinez. And we're talking about indigenous language education here in New Mexico. And I'd like to take a few calls. Let's go to Elaine in Albuquerque. Good morning, Elaine. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I'm calling because I have a question concerning teaching Pueblo languages in Albuquerque public schools. Is that what the guest was talking about when she said that there are some programs where Pueblo languages are being taught to students who attend Albuquerque public schools?
Chris?
Well, the languages in particular, that language programs I refer to are those that are community-based, meaning that some Pueblos have initiated their own language programs first as community-based efforts and only later have taken them into public school settings. Now, in those cases, there are specific maybe agreements that have been made between a tribe and a local school district to offer those classes. Now, within APS system, I know that there are language classes for Navajo, teaching Navajo. And there has been some, I think, move made to see about other languages. But again, one of the key elements here is that tribal communities, especially Pueblos, where Pueblo languages are concerned, really do have to be the impetus for those language programs to begin in public schools.
Does it also create some challenges in schools where you have a population of students that is culturally mixed and therefore you have, you know, perhaps Navajo students who are going to a class that's not open to students from
right.
other communities?
Yes, and that definitely is a challenge in a school system as big as APS because you don't have Native American students just from New Mexico. They're now from a lot of other tribes, and they are come from tribal heritage backgrounds in which sometimes these families are also wanting their children to learn other languages, but they just don't happen to be Pueblo languages.
Is there openness to members of different tribal communities learning language from each other's communities?
Among the Pueblos, no. Right now, I think their focus is primarily on making sure that the children from their communities have this opportunity if the tribe sanctions a program in a public school setting.
Let's take another call. Pam in Albuquerque. Good morning, Pam. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning. You mentioned that the group of Pueblo languages has no linguistic relationship to any other group in North America. And I was wondering if there's any historical linguistic relationship between Pueblo languages and any other language group anywhere in the world.
That's a good question, and one that often my students ask in my classes. And no, there is not. If you've ever taken a look at, like, say, in an encyclopedia where you see kind of the history of languages, you see this big tree of Indo-European languages, Native American languages are not on that tree. They have a separate tree, if you will. And so there are no linguistic ties like that with other languages around the world.
How would you say, when you talk about the tree of North American languages, indigenous languages, how healthy is that tree?
Well, if you look at the languages today, there's been estimates of somewhere around maybe 210 extant native languages in the United States today. When you compare that with probably, over maybe 500 to 1,000, maybe different languages before European contact, you know, these languages, 210 is a drop in the bucket. And what's even more disturbing and more serious is the fact that out of those 210 languages that are still around in the U.S., there's probably only about maybe 20 that have been about 20 maybe, that people say where children are still learning their native language as their first language, meaning before they ever enter formal schooling, only 20 nationally.
Let's take another call. Glenn in Jemez Springs. Good morning, Glenn. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for this program. And wanted to share something when you talked about the cultural mix. I, as a non-native teaching at a Pueblo school, had some unique experiences around the native language and myself not knowing them and so on. At times, some of the middle school kids would speak their native language, and it seemed to me to be an effort to kind of hide from me what they wanted to say. And at first, that was a bit threatening to me. But then I thought back to myself and how my own dad and his brothers and my grandma would speak their German and hide what they wanted to say from my brother and me. And I thought, okay, gringo, get over it. Just accept. And another experience was when some of the tribal leaders came to the school and dealt with some issues with the kids and allowed some of us non-natives to be present when they were speaking to the kids at one point, at another point, no. And the message was, you kids got to be speaking this language or it's going to get lost. And I thought that was a positive. I wish my dad and my grandmother would have pushed that with me in German, but they didn't. And I think it's a challenge for all of us who are not indigenous to be in relationship in schools. There are some sad stories up my way here about some of the white folks who didn't have a sensitivity and appreciation and respect and were asked to leave. And I think that's appropriate, too, if we can't accept the sacredness of another culture and their language. And have to meddle. So those are my comments, and thanks for your sharing. It's very insightful.
Let's take another call. Bill in Los Lunas. Good morning, Bill. You're on the air.
Good morning. Indigenous First Nation people come from Turtle Island, Turtle Mountain. Dene is the true language of the Navajo people. The Navajo language is a mixture of Spanish and indigenous language. The first Native Americans, in reality, are the Spaniards, because the Spaniards were the ones who named her America. There is many disclosures, misrepresentative of the Spanish, saying that they tried to destroy Native languages, which isn't so. There were indigenous people who learned the Spanish language for better communication to avoid conflicts. A universal language is always a good language, so people can get together and discuss their own heritages, but also avoid conflicts of war and whatever. Thank you.
Either of you have comments?
Well, to Glenn, I appreciate his comments, and certainly I'm an outsider to Pueblo communities, and have come to understand through the teaching of my colleagues and the people that I have worked with, that you have to respect the ways in which people approach their languages, their culture, and the ways in which they choose to use them. I think that it's a common phenomena, unfortunately, for monolinguals to think that if somebody is speaking another language in their presence, that they're speaking about them.
To be paranoid about.
I can imagine that these young people in the middle school have grown up together, have always spoken this language with each other. And one of the things we do know about language use is that it's habitual. Mm-hmm. So if you're used to speaking to each other in a particular language, it's very weird to turn around and use this other language with the person unless the situation, you know, requires it. So I think that people need to get over this idea that they're talking about you or they're trying to hide something from you. They're talking to each other because they have something to say in that language, and that's the best way to say it. So I think that's, you know, whether you speak a person's language or not, I think the most important thing is to respect it, to allow it to be used. You know, there's no danger of English going away. And so, you know, let these languages live side by side with the dominant languages.
Do you want to learn your heritage in indigenous language? And if so, why? What about this matters to you? Give us a call at 277-5866 locally here in Albuquerque. You can also call toll-free 877-899-5866. Again, that's 877-899-5866. We're talking about indigenous language instruction in New Mexico and various satellite issues related with two professors from the LLSS department at UNM. Let's take a call now from Magdalena in Albuquerque. Good morning, Magdalena. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'd like to say good morning to Dr. Lam Martinez and also Dr. Sims as well. It's really exciting to hear this conversation taking place. I am a public health researcher and professional, also affiliated with UNM. But what's important, given going right back to your question, is both a question statement and then I'll take comment off the air. I'll listen off the air. But is why does, in terms of indigenous language, why should this matter to us? And fundamentally, I believe that heritage languages in New Mexico are a critical part of public health. Because language is a foundation of health in terms of mental health, the emotional, the mm-hmm. spiritual, the physical, which all contribute to the community health level. I think that it's certainly the basis, the fundamental basis of identity within the individual and within the context. And then the fact that like all of the languages that New Mexico is comprised of, I think is a real richness of the organicness of this so-called call land of enchantment. It's the languages that make this the land of enchantment, and I think you have to, what I heard both doctors referring to, is that you have to live a language. It's not theoretical for the people mm-hmm. in the pueblos, for the, you know, those who speak Nuevo Mexicano, all of those elements. And language learning as a skill, but the living language, it comes from the heart. Mm-hmm. And if I could push any initiative within the state in public health, it would be heritage languages are a part of, crucial part of people's health. So really want to thank you for this conversation and really proud to see the work that these professors are doing. Thank you.
Magdalena's point is fascinating mm-hmm. to me because I, you know, when thinking about when I've ever tried to have a health conversation in a language that wasn't my first language, mm-hmm. it's extremely challenging. Right. How are there initiatives in New Mexico that are related to public health that serve the purpose of language, that kind of serve a second purpose, perhaps, mm-hmm. of language revitalization? Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, I'm thinking about some of the work that I've heard to provide translation services for people out on the Navajo Reservation, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. or traveling doctors, or mm-hmm. this dealing mm-hmm. specifically with this issue that Magdalena brought up.
I think that your caller makes a really excellent point in that that language really is a medium that really goes through a lot of other areas, not just education, certainly health, and that's really what I think most indigenous communities would point to, that, you know, the wholeness of people's lives, the wholeness of community life is dependent on those languages. Now, whether we see that taken into specific areas of education, such as health education, this, you know, translation for health usage in health professions. I think that's something that's probably been more recent, and we certainly see that taking off, especially with now languages like the Navajo language, where there have been quite extensive research and work done on translating, you know, health kinds of word usage, you know, things that would be used in that field. I don't see that as much yet in Pueblo languages, but we certainly see that in Navajo. Now,
is that partially a function of the size of communities?
Well, not only that, but and here's where sometimes the distinction between languages like, say, Navajo and Pueblo languages come in. Although Navajo has not been written that long, only within the last 100 years, the use of that particular language has actually been extended into other domains probably that it would not have had previously, meaning in the health field, maybe even in the science field, certainly in the education field. Extensive work done in terms of using both written and oral Navajo. And so where you have populations like the Navajo Reservation, which is so widespread across, you know, 4-state area, you do have populations that still, pockets where you still hear monolingual Navajo speakers. And so the need for being able then to make health accessible to these individuals does depend on them understanding. And so much of the translation work of Navajo in that field has been probably much more pronounced than, say, in other languages. Although we see that same need in Pueblo languages, where you do have elderly populations that still basically are monolingual native speakers.
The number to call to join this conversation is 277-5866 locally here in Albuquerque, or 877-899-5866. That's the toll-free number. Rebecca, you had a comment.
Yeah, I was going to say that in addition to the translation issue, I think something more fundamental in terms of health, something that the previous caller brought up, is what is the community's understanding or a belief about what is healthy, mm-hmm. or how does one achieve health? And so usually those kinds of of beliefs and practices are in the language. Mm-hmm. And so in order for you to be restored to health, you have to participate in some way in whatever that process is. And I think that, you know, especially when it comes to issues of emotional, spiritual, mm-hmm. mental health, these things are critical. And certainly, you know, although there are many wonderful things that are happening in Western medicine, that's not the only kind of medicine that exists.
Yeah. Let's take another call. Judy in Albuquerque. Good morning, Judy. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm curious about the linguistic characteristics of the small tree of Pueblo languages, how it's different from Indo-European. And I know that's a huge question, but I wonder if
talk
a little bit.
Are there some main differences?
Well, first of all, among the 19 Pueblo languages here in New Mexico, we have the Tewa speakers, T-E-W-A. That consists of 6 different dialects of that language, meaning that 6 different Pueblos speak their own dialect of Tewa. We have Tewa, which is spoken by 4 Pueblos here in New Mexico. Towa, which is only spoken by Jemez. And those linguists usually classify as part of a larger family of languages that they sometimes refer to as the Tonoan languages. Then there's a whole other family of languages called the Carrizan family or the Caras family, and that consists of 7 different Pueblos that speak that language. And then there's Zuni that is spoken only in Zuni. So you have this wide variety not only of language families, but then within families sometimes you have very distinct dialects. And those dialects are basically our identity markers, if you will, meaning that, for instance, if you spoke Caras from one Pueblo to another, you could pretty well tell which community they speakers come from just based on the way they talk.
I once had somebody describe to me the relationship between some West African languages as kind of like being pearls on a necklace, where if you were from a community, you might be able to understand or communicate with people maybe 2 or 3 pearls to the left and 2 or 3 pearls to the right. But then once you got a certain kind of number of beads away that you may lose the ability to communicate. Are these dialects that you're talking about within these language groups, do they function like that in the sense of that you can kind of...
They can. In fact, I'll take my own language family, you know, Caras or Carrizan, as some people refer to it. That can happen in terms of mutual intelligibility, that it gets further away as, say, the Western Caras speakers, Acoma and Laguna, are very close. But as you go north, then there are differences in vocabulary, you know, lexical items and that sort of thing. So sometimes, yeah, that continuum gets further and further away.
Let's take another call. Gretchen in Albuquerque. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a speech-language pathologist, and I work on one of the Pueblos outside of Albuquerque where Caras is the language. And I keep hearing that kids coming into school are getting weaker and weaker in their language. My question is, and I've also heard that years ago when kids entered school speaking only Caras, they were more successful academically. And my question is, I guess, what? And I didn't hear the beginning of the program, but what are your thoughts on dual language immersion being half day in Caras or any Pueblo language and half day in English and using the Caras to help support the academics?
Well,
Rebecca,
I think that, first of all, those are tribal decisions. Those are not school decisions. And I think one of the most important things that those of us who are outsiders can learn is that these kinds of decisions can only be made by tribal leaders, not by individuals in the communities, because of the relationship between sovereign nations and the state or the school district. So this is something really important to keep in mind. I think that any time that a community wishes to have their children immersed in the language is a wonderful thing. It's not going to hold the children back in terms of English in any way. But I have to say, as an educator, as a bilingual educator, and somebody who teaches courses that have to do with the development of English, that the onus in terms of developing children's academic abilities in English is also on the English-speaking teachers. And there are many ways in which that English can be supported and developed. I think a lot of times what has happened in the past continues to happen now is that there's a lack of understanding by school administrators or people who are making decisions about curriculum and the pedagogy that's being used in the schools that doesn't recognize what it means to come from a bilingual community and the kinds of support that students need in the English language. So that's one huge element that has to be addressed. The other, if the community, if the tribal leaders were to agree to something like an immersion, those would be decisions that they would have to make, and then they would have to come to agreements, formal agreements, with the schools.
Mm-hmm. Rebecca Bloom Martinez is a professor in the Language, Literacy, and Sociocultural Studies Department of the UNM College of Education. We're also joined this morning by Assistant Professor Chris Sims, and we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with your calls.
The New Mexico Health Insurance Alliance is proud to announce new high-deductible health plans that are designed to work with tax-free health savings accounts for small business owners and individuals who've had trouble keeping or finding health insurance. Check out all the plans at nmhia.com. See the qualifications and connect with a local agent. Finding health insurance is made easy at nmhia.com. That's nmhia.com. A message from the tax-exempt New Mexico Health Insurance Alliance.
I actually got this email. You siren, stop me before I bid again. I'm having way too much fun bidding and I'm becoming compulsive about checking the bids. Yes, I actually got this email. KUNM's online auction may be habit-forming. Do not combine with other shopping compulsions. If you love art or animals or pampering yourself or dining out or finding unique Valentine's Day gifts, click through to the auction from KUNM.org. Shop responsibly.
This is the KUNM Call-In Show. We're talking about Indigenous language instruction in New Mexico, and I'd like to get some calls now. Greg at Acoma, good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning, Professors Martinez and Kristin. I know
Ajit Jitwatma.
Just a real quick comment about, actually it's a question to both professors regarding, in your experience, what have you seen as the most effective means or methods used to continue languages, whether it's teaching or if it's tribes or several tribal nations that are trying to regain a language? Which methods do you think have been most effective and which can be implemented now?
In case you were listening and you had a hard time hearing him, the question was the most effective method. Mm. For teaching an Indigenous language?
Well, I think one of the things that we have, and I have to maybe preface my remarks by saying that teaching Pueblo languages is something actually fairly recent. Only since probably the mid-1990s have some communities actually taking on the work of teaching language, because prior to that, we really didn't have that need. And it was only recently when we realized that this phenomenon of language shift was happening in our communities, where more and more children were coming to school speaking English first rather than their native language, that efforts have been made to find what are some of the ways in which we can support the continued development of language. And in the case where children have not learned it as their first language, how do we go about teaching it, you know, almost like a second language? I know that some of the first program efforts that have happened in several Pueblo communities have followed what we call a language immersion approach, that model in which the children are placed in a environment in which the native language is used exclusively. And there are some good reasons for doing that, in that the children, if they've not had sufficient exposure to hearing how the language is used among fluent speakers, is really an important way in which children begin to pick that up. Many of our efforts, I should also preface by saying, have started as community efforts, meaning that some of these programs didn't start in schools. They started with community people who were fluent speakers. They started with, you know, grandmas and grandpas and aunties and uncles, you know, coming together to provide experiences with working with the children in just everyday kinds of environments. You know, I remember out in our community, we took kids on picnics, but it was all in the language. Everything was done in the language. That, combined with other support in the community, is what's really essential. It's not so much a method or a strategy, but it's also inclusive of a wider approach to support in native language development.
Let's take one more call. Lois in Albuquerque, good morning. You're on the air, and if you can keep your comments short, we're running up against the end of the show, and I'd like my panelists to be able to answer.
Thank you so much. This is such an important topic. I appreciate your covering it. I have a specific question about, we are in the middle of a legislative session now. One of the big hot topics is testing in the schools, reading by third grade, closing off social promotion, et cetera. I would really like your speakers to address what is the impact of this kind of political pressure toward English and standards and testing on the efforts in communities and in schools to support indigenous language revitalization.
Thank you, Lois. So that is a really critical element right now as we speak, because unfortunately what is happening in many instances where tribes have taken language programs into school settings is that because the current policies under NCLB and certainly even the current proposals being promulgated by the Public Education Department, those particular policies are impacting native language programs in schools where they are either being relegated to 30 minutes or less, or in some cases totally being eliminated. So I think the impact we're seeing is really detrimental to some of these beginning efforts that are being made to try to support language learning in school settings.
I also would just very quickly say that we need to be very careful about the initiative for early childhood education, these efforts not ignore the need for children to learn their tribal or heritage language, because if they don't, then as Dr. Sims has so clearly stated, these languages are in jeopardy.
You know, I keep coming back to this idea of power. As we've been talking, we were talking about non-Indigenous language speakers being threatened by people speaking in their Indigenous language, this issue of power. Do you see that as being part of this core of what we're talking about here, communities' self-determination and their ability to communicate and do what they want to do with their lives and their children and their education systems?
Definitely. I think that we are at a critical juncture in many of our Native communities about that idea of self-determining what that education is going to look like for our children. And across the board, I would say many tribal leaders, parents, and communities have expressed language as the priority in terms of educating their children.
So we have to listen to them.
Thanks so much to you both for joining me this morning on the KUNM Collins Show. Christine Sims is an assistant professor, and Rebecca Bloom Martinez is a professor. They're both with the Language, Literacy, and Sociocultural Studies Department in the UNM College of Education. Thanks to you both for joining us this morning. This has been the KUNM Collins Show. Mike Hess was answering your calls this morning. Roman Garcia is at the controls, and Andy Lyman is our news intern. I'm Elaine Baumgartel. Thanks so much for joining us. You can find audio from this show online at KUNM.org, and you can send us an email with your comments or questions to callinshow@KUNM.org. We'll be back next Thursday morning at 8 o'clock here on KUNM.
The coffee shop, Coffee for a Cause at 2nd and Lomas, is now serving breakfast and lunch. The menu includes gourmet paninis and many cafe specialties. The coffee shop is an employment training center of St. Martin's, and all proceeds go back into providing services for the homeless. Every purchase made at the coffee shop helps someone leave the streets. Now open for breakfast and lunch at 2nd and Lomas. A message from the tax-exempt St. Martin's Hospitality Center.
This is New Mexico's community-powered public radio, KUNM 89.9 Albuquerque, Santa Fe, KRRT 90.9 Arroyo Seco, Taos, KRRE 91.9 Las Vegas, KRAR 91.9 Española, and KBOM 88.7 Socorro, with translators K220EM 91.9 Aizi, K216CU 91.1 Cuba, and K213ET 90.5 Eagle Nest. Online at KUNM.